Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Podbay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Bird Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a crispy and crunchy 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working glue? Can you feel it? And I am flying solo tonight. My co-pilot will be the spirit of Michael W. Dean tonight. So if you hear some coughing and hacking in the background, that's him and not me, because it's really dry in Bear Saskatchewan. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. And we got something a little bit special going on tonight. Being that I'm flying solo, I'm going to talk about a single subject. Well, actually, my intention was to stick with a single subject, and that was going to be Frederick Bastiat and the law. And I went to reread the law over the past few days and gather my notes and the things that I wanted to highlight. And it's really amazing that the whole thing, I mean, it's like there's not any filler in there. The whole thing is very important. So I was going to read some excerpts from there and then offer some commentary. And then I figured, well, outside of libertarian circles, there's probably not a whole lot of people familiar with Frederick Bastiat. So I got to go a little bit into the biography. So I started looking at that. I'm like, hey, well, this guy's kind of interesting. And of course, he's famous for more than just writing the law. He has some other works that have endured the test of time and are still used today. As a matter of fact, they were modern economic primers and a strong influence on the Austrian School of Economics. So I'll be rattling off a whole lot of Bastiat. And then once I started thinking about Bastiat, I'm like, well, hey, there's another French guy that deserves some honorable mention, because some of that stuff ties in there too, and that's Alexis de Tocqueville. And then there were other things that were getting tied in, and well, here I am with, I'm going to be rambling on about the law and the other things. I have no idea how much I'm going to be able to cover tonight. I will probably only be able to really touch on part of it. I may continue the rest of it next week with Randy, or wait till the next time I'm flying solo again. We'll see what happens. I do have one little caveat. My French is horrible. Of all the languages that I've studied, that is one that I've had the most difficulty with getting good at pronunciations. So I'm going to butcher the French language and everybody that gets my way tonight. So let's start off with a little bit about Bastiat. As I mentioned, most people outside of libertarian circles probably have no idea who he is. If you go to an LP meeting, I'm not talking about the new LP, the folks that are washouts from the Republican Party that are just looking to find a place to be big fish because they were too small in the big pond that they were in before. I'm talking about the diehard libertarians, the people that adhere to the non-aggression principle, and they follow actual libertarian principles, not Republican light, not socially liberal, fiscally conservative, but I'm talking about real libertarians. Those people are familiar with Bastiat. If you go to a mainline Republican Party meeting, I would doubt that too many people would have a clue on who he is at all. Maybe one or two. Same with the Republican Liberty Caucus meetings. I don't think that he's going to be too widely read in there. But he's definitely not somebody that's taught about in the traditional government schools. His ideas are following the classical liberal school. He would be a very close comparison to probably a Thomas Jefferson, in my view, would be the closest comparison. But once again, very interesting guy and very diverse background as far as the things that he's been involved in. So Claude Frederick Bastiat, I had forgotten that his first name is actually Claude Frederick and not just Fred, was born on June 29th of 1801, and he died at a young age on the 24th of December, 1850. And he was a French economist and author who was a prominent member of the French liberal school. As I mentioned, he was from the classical liberal school of thought. Here in America, he'd be called a classical liberal. He developed the economic concept of opportunity cost and introduced the parable of the broken window. which really plays into a lot of government economic planning and stimulus projects. He was also a Freemason and member of the French National Assembly. Now, I had remembered that he was a politician, and I wasn't really sure what he had done. I hadn't remembered it. It had been a long time since I'd looked at his biography. But he was a member of the French National Assembly, so he was a politician. I guess he could fall in the category of statesman. That's not a title that I would go throwing around a whole lot. As an advocate of classical economics and the economics of Adam Smith, his views favored a free market and influenced the Austrian school. Bastiat was born in Bayonne, Aquitaine, a port town in the south of France on the Bay of Biscay, on 29 June 1801. His father, Pierre Bastiat, was a prominent businessman in the town. His mother died in 1808 when Frederick was 7 years old. His father moved inland to the town of Mougron, with Frederick following soon afterward. The Bastiat estate in Mougron had been acquired during the French Revolution and had previously belonged to the Marquis of Poyan. I'm not sure how it was acquired. It doesn't say. Hopefully it wasn't anarcho-communized. Pierre Bastiat died in 1810, leaving Frederick an orphan. He was fostered by his paternal grandfather and his maiden aunt, Justine Bastiat. He attended school in Bayonne, but his aunt thought poorly of it, and so enrolled him in the Saint-Sever. At age 17, he left school at Sorezé to work for his uncle in his family's export business. It was the same firm where his father had been a part. Bastiat began to develop an intellectual interest. He no longer wished to work with his uncle and desired to go to Paris for formal studies. This hope never came true, as his grandfather was in poor health and wished to go to the Mougron estate. Bastiat accompanied him and cared for him. The next year, when Bastiat was 24, his grandfather died, leaving the young man with the family estate, thereby providing him with the means to further his theoretical inquiries. Bastiat developed intellectual interest in several areas, including philosophy, history, politics, religion, travel, poetry, political economy, and biography. After the middle class revolution of 1830, Bastiat became politically active and was elected Justice of the Peace of Mougron in 1830, and to the Council General, County Level Assembly of Landes in 1832. He was elected to the National Legislative Assembly soon after the French Revolution of 1848. His public career as an economist began only in 1844, when his first article was published in the Journal des Economistes during October that year. Once again, I apologize for butchering the French language. It was ended by his untimely death in 1850. Bastiat contracted tuberculosis, probably during his tours throughout France to promote his ideas, and that illness eventually prevented him from making further speeches, particularly at the Legislative Assembly, to which he was elected in 1848 and 1849, and ended his life. During the autumn of 1850, he was sent to Italy by his doctors. He first traveled to Pisa, then on to Rome. On 24 December 1850, Bastiat called those with him to approach his bed. Some of his works that he did, the first one I'm going to talk about is called Economic Sophisms and the Candlemaker's Petition. This is a really interesting summary that they have here. And by the way, the biography that I'm going from came from Wikipedia. Contained with economic sophisms is a satirical parable known as the Candlemaker's Petition, in which candlemakers and tallow producers lobby the Chamber of Deputies of the French July Monarchy, 1830 to 1848, to block out the sun to prevent its unfair competition with their products. Also included in the sophisms is a facetious petition to the king asking for a law forbidding the usage of everyone's right hand, based on a presumption by some of his contemporaries that more difficulty means more work, and more work means more wealth. It's really interesting to hear these ideas, the idea of blocking out the sun to prevent unfair competition. Doesn't that sound like something of the modern day? Doesn't that sound like the silliness that has gone on for as long as economic transactions have existed, and not to mention this idea that making work more difficult will create more wealth. It's funny, history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly has a tendency to rhyme, as Mark Twain had said. A famous section of economic sophisms concerns the way that tariffs are inherently counterproductive. Bastiat posits a theoretical railway between Spain and France that is built in order to reduce the cost of trade between the two countries and goods, and therefore reduces the price at market for those goods. However, each country's producer begins to criticize the governments because the other country's producers can now provide certain goods to the domestic market at reduced price. Domestic producers of these goods are afraid of being outcompeted by the new viable industry from the other country. And I'll be back after this trip to the market.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agrist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar, and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. And some people will try dirty tricks to silence your voice. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agorist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, you cannot tolerate any skullduggery. So go with agoristhosting.com. Have a WordPress or blog site, but you're not satisfied with performance or uptime? Or just want raw hosting? Want to pay with Bitcoin? Agorist Hosting specializes in high-performance hosting with personalized service. Go to agristhosting.com and click on the button that says Get Hosted. That's agristhosting.com.
Freedom Fiends. And we are back. This is Lou, and I'm talking about Frederick Bastiat. And before we went to break, I was talking about his book. It's talking about using rail to transport goods from one country to another. And however each country's producers, and this was after the train was getting the goods to market cheaper and fresher and everything else. However, each country's producers begin to criticize the governments because the other country's producers can now provide certain goods to the domestic market at reduced price. Domestic producers of these goods are afraid of being outcompeted by the newly viable industry from the other country. So these domestic producers demand that tariffs be enacted to artificially raise the cost of the foreign goods back to their pre-railroad levels, so that they can continue to compete. Bastiat makes two significant statements here. One, even if the producers in a society are benefited by these tariffs, which Bastiat claims they are not, the producers in that society are clearly hurt by the tariffs, as they are now unable to secure the goods they want at the low price at which they should be able to secure them. Two, the tariffs completely negate any gains made by the railroad and therefore make it essentially pointless. To further demonstrate his statements, Bastiat suggests, in a classic reductio ad absurdum, that rather than enacting tariffs, the government should simply destroy the railroad anywhere that foreign goods can outcompete local goods. Since this would be just about everywhere, he goes on to suggest that this government should simply build a broken or negative railroad right from the start and not waste time with tariffs and rail building. And the argument about tariffs continues to this day. And what Bastiat points out and what most people fail to notice is that by artificially raising the cost of foreign goods, those foreign goods are made less competitive. The domestic goods are not made any better. They're just that they stay as they are. And when they are protected, there's absolutely no incentive for them to increase in efficiency or innovation. Protective tariffs are nothing short of economic affirmative action for the politically connected. And here's a thought. Let's say an administration wanted to promote something like, oh, I don't know, green energy, like wind and solar, and it happened to be that the producers of batteries and wind turbines and all these different things, let's say that they were politically connected. And then let's say the cost of coal and natural gas and oil, let's say those things became artificially more expensive because of taxes put on them, or maybe, oh, I don't know, costly regulations that add to the cost of production. And then what if that administration had said something like, well, see how inefficient coal and natural gas and oil are? And this is why we absolutely positively have to switch over to green energy, renewable energy. Do you think that might be a little bit fishy? Does that sound a little bit familiar? And yet, here we are, the following administration later, people are talking about using tariffs to protect the businesses that are inefficient. And furthermore, what has not been done, as I already said, the productive has been crippled, the unproductive has not been. So it's just a continuation of propping up failure. One does not have a successful economy by propping up the inefficient. So just a little something to think about before people start getting the supply and demand axis of fields going. You know, think a little bit like an economist in there rather than just flying off of the handle. What is seen and what is unseen? And this is probably one of the best ones that he has. It's the most common one. His 1850 essay, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the original French title, What is Seen and What is Unseen, through the parable of the broken window, he introduced the concept of opportunity cost in all but name. This term was not coined until 60 years after his death in 1914 by Friedrich von Wieser. And the broken window fallacy is the idea that an economy can become stronger through destruction by having disasters happen. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we come back.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
You know you want to be a filmmaker. As Rick of Rick and Morty says, school's not a place for smart people. Nowhere is this more true than film school. Don't waste years and $100,000 being taught by those who couldn't make it. Just get a camera and a $7 Kindle version of $30 Film School 3rd Edition. $30 Film School 3rd Edition is the recent update on the classic 2003 book that helped spark the do-it-yourself filmmaking revolution. Written by DIY filmmaker Michael W. Dean, whose high-quality, low-budget movies star Academy Award winners and nominees, get worldwide distribution, and have been in many respected film festivals. The first two editions sold over 100,000 copies, and it's recommended reading in many colleges. The book is back, updated for today's high-def consumer cameras, but still has the same self-starter ethic and tips that no other book has. Get it delivered this minute to your Kindle or phone for only $7. Go to Amazon and type in $30 Film School 3rd Edition. That's $30 Film School 3rd Edition.
This is Lou, and I'm talking about the broken window fallacy. When Frederick Bastiat wrote What is Seen and What is Unseen, he told a story of a boy who mistakenly breaks out a window by playing carelessly with a ball or something like that. And the window of a local shop is broken out, and the people are standing around and they're like, "Oh my God, this is so horrible. Oh, this is so unfortunate." And along comes a man and he says, "Oh, this is not a tragedy at all, because with this broken window here, the glazier will come out and he will be paid to repair this window. And with that money, the glazier will pay his employees, and they will be able to go out and buy goods, and the glazier himself, he'll be able to go out and buy goods. So maybe he'll go out and buy a sweater or a book or some sort or another." And it, all of a sudden, the people that were standing around saying how unfortunate it was that the window was broken are now buying into it. But that's not the truth, though, because the store owner could have gone out and bought that same sweater, that same book, that same coffee, that's taken his wife out to dinner, and all this stuff could have happened anyway. So the economy would still have all those things, but now, because the window was broken, the economy is minus a window. And this is something that you hear quite often when there's a natural disaster like a hurricane or an earthquake. Somebody will inevitably say, but the economic growth is going to be spurred by this. You know, kind of like in Philadelphia, there's probably going to be an awful lot for rebuilding the city after people freaked out over the Eagles winning their first Super Bowl. I mean, as a matter of fact, the Tide Pod sales have increased because somebody decided they wanted to enjoy a horse pie. And coming from Detroit, one thing that I can say is I'll never have to worry about the people of Detroit rioting over the Detroit Lions winning a Super Bowl. I doubt that's ever going to happen. So, but there's plenty of other things to write about there. So anyway, bottom line is the economy loses through this destruction. It's not the stimulus that people claim it to be. And this applies to all stimulus projects. But anyway, more on that in our time. Bastiat also had a debate with Proudhon. He famously engaged in a debate between 1849 and 1850 with Pierre-Joseph Proudhon about his legitimacy of interest. As Robert LaRue argued, Bastiat had the conviction that Proudhon's anti-interest doctrine was a complete antithesis of any serious approach. Proudhon famously lost his temper and declared to Bastiat, "Your intelligence is asleep, or rather it has never been awake. You are a man for whom logic does not exist. You do not hear anything. You do not understand anything. You are without philosophy, without science, without humanity. Your ability to reason, like your ability to pay attention and make comparisons, is zero. Scientifically, Mr. Bastiat, you are a dead man." Wow, this is probably not something that I would say about Bastiat, but anyway. And then finally, his other book was The Law, which was published in 1850, the year that he died. And this book here, a little side note, I'm using the Sterling translation, which is from 1874. And the thing that really fascinates me about this is 1874. This is supposed to be primitive times. This is supposed to be a time when people are not educated enough to read great language and understand great ideas. And yet, if you look at the language that was used in writing at that time and was read by the common man, it makes the intellectuals of the modern day sound like simpletons. Like the language has really been dumbed down to the idiocracy that the world has become. But anyway, so The Law, like I said, published in 1850, and the translation was 1874. The law perverted, the law, and in its wake, all the collective forces of the nation. The law, I say, not only diverted from its proper function, but made to pursue one entirely contrary. Law, because the law guilty of that very iniquity, which it was its mission to punish. Truly, this is a serious fact, if it exists, and one to which I feel bound to call the attention of my fellow citizens. We hold from God the gift which, as far as we are concerned, contains all others, life, physical, intellectual, and moral life, but cannot support itself. But life cannot support itself. He who has bestowed it has entrusted us with the care of supporting it, of developing it, and of perfecting it. to that, he has provided us with a collection of wonderful faculties. He has plunged into us the midst of a variety of elements. It is the application of our faculties to these elements that the phenomena of assimilation and of appropriation by which life pursues the circle, which has been assigned to it, are realized. Existence, faculties, assimilation. In other words, personality, liberty, property. This is man. In the standard American English context, I would refer to life, liberty, and property. And these are the classical liberal traditions of life, liberty, and property. And what he proposes is the equivalent of, I guess, a night watchman state would be the best way to put it. If you look at the classical liberal philosophy, minarchy, minstatism, whatever you want to call it, it calls for a night watchman state, which is only there to keep an eye on things when the population is asleep. Kind of like a Maytag repairman that only comes out when absolutely necessary. So what is the point of law? According to Frederick Bastiat and the classical liberals, it is to protect the rights of man, to protect his life, liberty, and property. Now the question is, what has it done? Has it been the great protector? As Thomas Jefferson had said, a government that is strong enough to give you everything that you want is also strong enough to take it all away. Using that rationale, isn't a government that's strong enough to protect your liberty also strong enough to take it all away? And I think it's pretty safe to say that the track record has shown that it has done more taking than protecting. So what is law? It depends on who you talk to. There's a variety of different things. If you talk to the common man out on the street, he may consider law to be the words that fill the many pages, that fill the many volumes, that fill the many shelves and the many rooms of a law library. All these things that you are required to do and prohibited to do. It could be every rule, regulation, threat of force if you do not comply. And that's how you ensure freedom, with these many volumes and these many rooms of these law libraries, so many that not even those that enforce the law are able to keep track of them. Is that the law? Or is it something entirely unto itself, an entity of its own? Is it something like maybe from a higher power brought down off a mountaintop on stone tablets? The nice thing about stone tablets was you could only put so many on there, and only so many could be carried around, so you didn't have quite as many laws. Now, if you go by the biblical story, there were only 10 of them that came down from the mountaintop, the 10 commandments. Wouldn't it be nice to only have 10 laws? So if you also look at common law or natural law, you know, those are other things. And of course, you got the people that talk about all these different types of things, you know, the fringe on the flag and admiralty law and all this other stuff. And it's just a big giant mess. And it does nothing to protect the life, liberty, and property of others. How does a regulation that sets the minimum length of a woman's bathing suit at the beach protect life, liberty, and property? How does a law that requires somebody to go in front of a vehicle waving a flag when automobiles were still new, how does that protect life, liberty, and property? How does the laws of slavery protect life, liberty, and property? It certainly does nothing to protect the life, liberty, and property of the slave. But anyway, in regards to natural law, Lysander Spooner wrote this: "It's the science of mine and thine, the science of justice, the science of all human rights, of all man's rights of person and property, of all his rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is the science which alone can tell any man what he can and cannot do, what he can and cannot have, what he can and cannot say without infringing the rights of any other person. From the interwebs, Chris Snyder, who frequently talks about natural law. Natural law is a theory based on a society's need for civility. It recognizes property ownership as the starting point as to where grievances start and end. It recognizes that the first step in ownership is owning your own labor. From there, you have standing to address any actions associated with things you earn or trade for, and any harms or claims related to them. Settling these claims gives us the core of common law, which sets precedent, which lays out the guidelines for a civil society. When it comes to the guidelines for a civil society, when it comes to protecting life, liberty, and property, the question is, how many laws are necessary? How many things have to be scribbled down on paper to do that? And what happens, as Bastiat is talking about, where the law becomes perverted and goes away from its original intent? Plato wrote, and this is one of the many translations, good people don't require laws to behave. Bad people will ignore those laws. They will find a way to get around these laws, as is seen commonly. And Tacitus wrote, the more corrupt the state, the more it legislates. Sound familiar? We'll be back.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Cell 411 is a great free app for Android and iPhone. It allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with crime, emergencies, setting up neighborhood watch, activism, and even protecting your kids from bullies on the street or at school. Cell 411 gives your cells turn-by-turn directions to your location with one touch on your phone. There is also a Bluetooth panic button available that can be worn on your wrist, belt, or around your neck. Cell 411 has real-time chat for each alert so you can discuss the incident with family or friends in real-time video streaming. The video is stored on Cell 411's servers so your evidence cannot be deleted if your phone is taken or destroyed. Cell 411 has decentralized ride sharing that allows for payment in any form, crypto, barter, silver, cash, etc. Cell 411 does not take a cut of your fare. Get Cell 411 free on Google Play and the iTunes Store, or go to getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.
The law with Frederick Bastiat. Personality, liberty, and property. This is man. It is of these three things that it may be said, apart from all demagogue subtlety, that they are interior and superior to all human legislation. It is not because men have made laws that personality, liberty, and property exist. On the contrary, it is because personality, liberty, and property exist beforehand that men make laws. What then is law? As I have said elsewhere, it is the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense. Now, one of the things that comes up with this argument, and a lot of people are making this argument as far as the Bordertarian stuff, the alt-right folks are using this idea that, well, we're getting together and we're doing this cooperatively and everything else, but they're actually using government to do it, which is not cooperatively. It's not voluntarily. It's disguised as something else. It is coercive in nature. But anyway, back to the law. Nature, or rather God, has bestowed upon every one of us the right to defend his person, his liberty, and his property, since these are three constituent or preserving ends of life. Elements, each of which is rendered complete by the others and cannot be understood without them. For what are our faculties but the extension of our personality, and what is property but an extension of our faculties? If every man has the right of defending, even by force, his person, his liberty, and his property, a number of men have the right to combine together, to extend, to organize a common force, to provide regularly for this defense. So this is voluntary. When you have people getting together and working cooperatively and pooling their resources, that's when you have voluntarism. But when you have the coercive manner of, okay, this is what's going to happen and this is what you're going to pay for it. Oh, you don't like the service? Well, too bad. Vote harder next time, which is what happens with the government services. Collective right then has its principles, its reason for existing, its lawfulness, an individual right, and the common force cannot rationally have any other end or any other mission than that of the isolated forces for which it substituted. Thus, as the force of an individual cannot lawfully touch the person, the liberty, or the property of another individual, for the same reason, the common force cannot lawfully be used to destroy the person, the liberty, or the property of individuals or of classes. For this perversion of force would be, in one case, as in, for who will say force has been given to us, not to defend our rights, but to annihilate the equal rights of our brethren? That kind of sounds a little bit like those tariffs and economic restrictions. And if this is not true of every individual force acting independently, how can it be true of the collective force, which is only the organized union of isolated force? One of the questions that comes up with this, and I want to say that this comes from Bastiat, and I can't remember where it was from, and I can't remember specifically if it was from Bastiat, but the question arises, because what they're talking about is the delegation of authority here. As each person has a right to protect their own life, liberty, and property, but they do not have the right to violate the life, liberty, and property of another, they can delegate the right of protection, such as hiring the night watchman. But the question is, how can a person, or even a group of persons, delegate a right that they themselves do not have? So if each person does not have the right to violate the life, liberty, and property of another, then how can they delegate that right to a third party? So it's something to ponder. Nothing, therefore, can be more evident than this. The law is the organization of the natural right of lawful defense. It is the substitution of collective for individual forces for the purpose of acting in the sphere in which they have a natural right to act, of doing what they have a right to do, to secure persons' liberty and properties, and to maintain each in its right so as to cause justice to reign over all. And we'll be back in the second hour.
Are you a political activist who does things that the government might not like? Then this free ebook may save your life. RATS is your guide to protecting yourself against snitches, informers, informants, agents provocateur, narcs, finks, and similar vermin. RATS was written by OG libertarian Claire Wolfe. RATS is a short book, easy to read, and available free in many formats. Download RATS free at rats-nosnitch.com. That's rats-nosnitch.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon high atop Financial Peace Plaza on the artificial satellite Loop Pair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. And I am Lou, and I'm flying solo tonight and talking about Frederick Bastiat and the law. So tonight I am breaking the law with Frederick Bastiat, or breaking down the law, perhaps maybe a better way of putting it. So for those of you who are just joining us, to include the late arriving stations, who is Frederick Bastiat? He is a classical liberal from France. He lived from 1801 to 1850, and he wrote books such as The Law and What is Seen and What is Unseen, And he's famous for being an economist, a philosopher, statesman. He really got a lot of ideas for a segment. Some of his thoughts, some of the things that he had come up with have helped to lay the foundation of the Austrian School of Economics. So very interesting guy, has had a great impact. And outside of libertarian or classical liberal circles, is virtually unheard of. This guy and his thoughts are not discussed in the public schools or in the mainline political thought. It just doesn't exist. But I think he should. He's definitely got some wonderful ideas. And the things that he's talked about, as I mentioned before, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And a lot of the things that he wrote about is still going on today, which really lets me know that in over 160 years, humanity has learned nothing. They're still making the same mistakes, still reciting the same ideas. So what is the law? Under the classical liberal tradition, the purpose of the law is to protect the life, liberty, and property of all. Not for particular classes, not for some at the expense of the others, but to protect the life, liberty, and property of everybody alike. And the question is, does this happen? As Bastiat writes, unhappily, law is by no means confined to its own department, nor is it merely in some indifferent and debatable views that is left its proper sphere. It has done more than this. It has acted in direct opposition to its proper end. It has destroyed its own object. It has been employed in annihilating that justice which it ought to have established, in effacing against rights that limit which was its true mission to respect. It has placed the collective force in the service of those who wish to traffic without risk and without scruple in the persons, the liberty, and the property of others. Has converted plunder into a right that it may protect, that it may protect it, and lawful defense into a crime that it may punish it. Bastiat, I don't know if he coined the phrase, but certainly my first understanding of the concept of legal plunder comes from reading Bastiat and also hearing people talk about him and talking about how much he wrote about plunder, both legal and extra-legal. How has this perversion of law been accomplished, and what has resulted from it, he writes. And that's really a good question. If you go by the classical liberal view that the purpose of the law is to defend life, liberty, and property, and not to try to impose views and wishes and beliefs upon others, and not to try to socially engineer or centrally plan the lives of everybody, then you have to ask, you know, what happened? Well, quite simply, it was made possible to attempt to socially engineer and centrally plan to impose views and beliefs on others. And there was absolutely no restraint against it, because as he says, plunder has been converted into a right and lawful defense into a crime. Think about this. And this is particularly true in the liberal democracies and the representative republics out there. The notion that the politicians represent you, they are your representatives, they are your servants. Well, if they are your representatives and servants, shouldn't they be following your instructions? Shouldn't you be barking the orders at them instead of the other way around? Name another relationship where the servants bark the orders and determine what the punishment will be for disobedience. There isn't one. This is the only case where it happens is in government. And are these people representing you? Well, if I hire somebody to represent me, and the euphemism of is used quite often by people to justify things. They say, well, we hire representatives to go take care of our business for us. Okay. If you hire somebody and they do the opposite of what you want them to do, and you tell them, maybe you write your representative, you give them written instructions on what you expect, and they don't do it, are they really your representative? Do they really work for you? It's not representation. Can you fire them? No, you can't. Therefore, they're not your employees. So, how has this perversion of law been accomplished, and what has resulted from it? The law has been perverted into the influence of two different, very different causes, bare egotism and false philanthropy. Let us speak of the former. Self-preservation and development is the common aspiration of all men in such a way that if everyone enjoyed the free exercise of his faculties and the free disposition of their fruits, social progress would be incessant, uninterrupted, inevitable. There's also another disposition which is common to them. This is to live and to develop when they can at the expense of one another. There is no rash imputation emanating from a gloomy, uncharitable spirit. History bears witness to the truth of it by the incessant wars, the migration of races. The sacerdotal disposition has its origin in the very constitution of man, in that primitive and universal, invincible sentiment which urges it forward, its well-being, and makes it seek to escape pain. In that regard, one of his quotes, which is not listed in this section here, comes to mind. Government is the great fiction through which everybody endeavors to live at the expense of everybody else. Government is the great fiction through which everybody endeavors to live at the expense of everybody else. I want to go back to how things became the way that they did. Under the classical liberal tradition of the law is only meant to protect life, liberty, and property, a question that should be asked is, how many laws are absolutely necessary to protect life, liberty, and property? Once it is illegal to harm another person, either physically harming them, kidnapping them, beating or murdering them, after it is a crime to steal from them, to take their property, to commit fraud, how many things need to be illegal? How many activities need to be criminalized once you have covered these basic things that cover the responsibility of government, of protecting life, liberty, and property? How many laws outside of that scope have to be created, and for what purpose? For the prohibitionists, I made mention of this probably a week or two ago. I had talked about the bootleggers and Baptists when it came to the prohibition of alcohol, the Baptists being the teetotalers, the ones that felt nobody should drink alcohol. And granted, not all Baptists are prohibitionists, but there are a great many out there that say, no, this cannot happen. It's just like the people that are supporting the war on the devil's lettuce, the cannabis prohibition. How does this prohibition, be it the devil's lettuce or alcohol or anything else, how does that protect life, liberty, and property? Furthermore, how does it protect life, liberty, and property without affecting the life, liberty, and property of another? Under the concept of self-ownership, I own my body. I have the highest claim to my body because it is my life. It is my property. And do I not have the liberty to ingest alcohol or to smoke the wacky tobacco if I choose to? Who am I harming but myself? If I'm even harming myself at all, do I not own myself? What gives somebody else a higher claim to how I will live my life? Particularly, they cannot show demonstrable harm to themselves by my actions. There is no demonstrable harm. All it is the imposition of one person's will against another, be it the will of the minority or the will of the majority, is the imposition of wills. So this is how it went out of control, because people said, well, this needs to happen. There was necessity that was claimed. Because quite often, as H.L. Mencken had said, the urge to save humanity is almost always a false front for the urge to rule it. There were people that said, well, alcohol can't be consumed, or the devil's lettuce can't be consumed, or people cannot gamble, or people cannot charge interest, or people cannot do all of these different things. People cannot operate a business without permission from the government because of some vital necessity. All that was people putting their fears or their preferences into an argument to violate the life, liberty, and property of others. So, where do we go from here? How do we get past this? Personally, I think that the public is probably so used to all of the different words that have been scribbled down, all the different laws, commandments, ordinances, orders, everything else, that they're unwilling to let it go, and I doubt if it could be rolled back. But anyway, more on the law after this trip to the market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is Michael W. Dean's novel from the year 2000. It's entirely fictional.
Allegedly.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is a glorious story about a low-rent post-punk rock star, Cash Newman. Cash Newman is entirely made up.
Not a guarantee.
And is not based on any particular person.
Not a guarantee.
Cash Newman has lots of fun with strange ladies and with the party favors.
Don't try this at home.
And he hangs out with people who commit 3 felonies a page.
But that's none of my business.
It's all in good fun. And at the same time, it's kind of deep. But always spunky. Michael recently updated the book to a much better version. He released it as a paperback and for the first time on Kindle. As with this and all Freedom Fiends related things, please rate and review. Get Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women now on Amazon or at michaelwdean.com.
For entertainment purposes only.
Frederick Bastiat and the law. And talking about how did the law become what it is today. A friend of mine, Mike Meharry, writes in his website, Godarchy, an article titled, "But It's the Law." Over the last few weeks, there have been several high-profile stories in the news about ICE deporting illegal immigrants who were brought to this country as children. Many people, especially political conservatives, seem unmoved by the gut-wrenching, tearful goodbyes. They paper over any sense of compassion with a stark statement. It's the law. Quite simply, it's the law. That's it. As if just dropping those words will change everything. It's the law. And I asked earlier on, what is the law? What exactly is it? Is it the words that fill up the many law books, that fill up the many shelves in the many rooms of the law library? Is it something that came from a higher power that was brought down the mountaintop on stone tablets? I never went any further on that when I asked that earlier. Where do the laws come from? The laws that we deal with on a daily basis, because it doesn't matter where you live, there's going to be laws. You know, there's an old saying, we're a nation of laws. And it should say, we're a nation of many, 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 many laws and rules and regulations and codes and ordinances and orders being barked and everything else. Many, many laws. How did it get that way? You know, what are these laws? And quite frankly, once you get past what Bastiat describes as the legitimate role of government being the protection of life, liberty, and property, anything else beyond that is an opinion backed up at the barrel of a gun. It is not the creation of some higher power. It's not the creation of the will of the collective. It's a bunch of politicians got together, possibly paid off by some lawyers, and they said, hey, we have these ideas. And they scribbled these words down on paper. And so you have the declarations of people like Nancy Pelosi, Paul Ryan, Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell, and all the ones that have come before them, the ones that have said that women need to wear a certain length bathing suit, and there needs to be somebody at the beach to measure it. The people that said, you know what, let's make alcohol illegal. What could go wrong? the people that said the same thing about cannabis and so many other things. The people that said, no, there must be health inspectors, because without laws and health inspectors, the people that own restaurants would take the meat out of their freezers and store it in the parking lot. And then, of course, people, the customers would have no choice but to eat it because whatever their stupid reasons are. By saying it's the law as a justification, it's not an argument. It's an appeal to authority. It's an appeal to the opinions of politicians, the declarations, even if those opinions violate the life, liberty, and property that government is supposed to protect. Mike continues on with, ironically, many of these same people claim the government would have to pry their guns out of their cold, dead hands. But couldn't the government authorities just pass a law? Wouldn't they create an irresistible moral obligation to hand over those firearms? The way some of these people talk, I'm pretty certain they would have compliantly turn over their guns using their very warm, very much alive hands if the authorities told them to. Obedience seems to be their highest moral end. According to the law, the words that have been written down on paper by politicians, Rosa Parks belonged on the back of the bus. Slaves belonged in the cotton fields. The German Jews belonged in the oven. Harriet Tubman belonged at the end of a rope for circumventing Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution and the Fugitive Slave Clause that's contained in there. That was the law. So, about these laws, what are we looking at here? Is this a case of... And I had the quotes written down here, but I can't seem to find them. Martin Luther King said that... Well, I'll try and find them and I'll come back to it. But anyway, we'll be back.
And the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
And I'm talking about Frederick Bastiat and the law. And in response to those who justify any sort of scumbag activity on the part of the police or the politicians by shouting the old battle cry of statism, it's the law. Martin Luther King said, one has a moral right to disobey unjust laws. Thomas Jefferson took it a step further and said, if a law is unjust, a man is not only right to disobey it, he is obligated to do so. Which brings up a couple questions. One, how do you know when a law is unjust? Most people can't answer that. I mean, they could say, well, if it's not fair, but when is it actually considered unjust? When did the segregation laws become unjust? I would imagine that in 1950, popular opinion was of the mind that, well, segregation has been in place for all this time, so obviously it must be just, because most people view legality and morality in the exact same light. They view it as the same thing. And it's not. It's far from it. But eventually there came a time where the morality of segregation did not keep up with the legality of it. Same with slavery. For centuries, probably millennia, slavery was a perfectly acceptable practice. in, I believe it was 1632 or so, the Quakers began the abolitionist movement here in the United States. And they pushed and they pushed those utopians that thought that there would be another way of the cotton getting picked and other chores getting done. You know, so slavery, the question is slavery or is segregation or is any other policy that violates the rights, the forbidding women from owning property or from voting. Well, I think everybody should be forbidden from voting, but all these different prohibitions that violate the life, liberty, and property of somebody else, they were always unjust. They were always illegitimate. It's just that the perception that they were unjust and illegitimate didn't happen until much later. And there's a lot of people out there that will do that screaming of, it's the law, it's the law. And they will go by that. It doesn't matter what the person is accused of. Because they have violated some words scribbled down on paper, they're considered to be horrible. And the notion innocent until proven guilty really doesn't apply, at least to most people in America. As soon as somebody is arrested, people start convicting them in their minds. It's like the kangaroo court of public opinion. And this is nothing new. Alexis de Tocqueville, in his book, Democracy in America, wrote about this. And this is something that made me question whether America has ever been this bastion of freedom that it was always considered to be. Because people usually say, well, yeah, back in the old days, people didn't take any crap from the government. You know, they did their own thing. But something that he recognized when he was here, during my stay in the United States, I witnessed a spontaneous formation of committees in a country for the pursuit and prosecution of a man who had committed a great crime. In Europe, a criminal is an unhappy man who is struggling for his life against the agents of power, while the people are merely a spectator of the conflict. But in America, he is looked upon as an enemy of the human race. And the whole of mankind is against him. In America, he is looked upon as an enemy of the human race. And the whole of mankind is against him. And I don't think that has changed in the amount of time that it's been since de Tocqueville wrote that. I think that people here in America have a tendency to convict in the court of public opinion immediately upon the time that there's an arrest. And they deem this person to be a devil on earth, a demon possessed of sorts. Going back to Bastiat and the law, when he was talking about legal plunder, derive life and enjoyment from a perpetual search and appropriation, that is, from a perpetual application of his faculties to objects or from labor. This is the origin of property. But yet he may live and enjoy by seizing and appropriating the production of the faculties of his fellow men. This is the origin of plunder. And this theme continues on. Franz Oppenheimer wrote about this in The State. Oppenheimer wrote that there were two ways to obtain wealth or to make money. The first being the economic means, and the second being the political means, or Bastiat uses the words labor or plunder. When does plunder cease then? When it becomes more burdensome and more dangerous than labor. It is very evident that the proper aim of law is to oppose the powerful obstacle of collective force to this fatal tendency, that all its measures should be in favor of property and against her. The opening line of that period, more burdensome and more dangerous than labor. And what he's saying is that rolling over and accepting plunder, to accept tyranny because it is the law, because politicians have written words down on paper commanding you to do this and forbidding you to do that, by accepting that, you are accepting being plundered. You're accepting the tyranny that comes with it. And the only way to beat that is to resist. It doesn't, although it implies using violence, I don't know that it necessarily means violence. It could be stern resistance. I don't really know. But here's the thing. if the law is meant to protect life, liberty, and property, and the law is able to use the force of violence to protect life, liberty, and property, but it uses this violence and force for the purpose of plunder, then what does that say of the government, where these individuals have joined together to collectivize force on their behalf of defense, but it has been used against them? It's almost like the story of the golem that the village rabbis created to protect the village, and that became a monster that terrorized them. But the law is made generally by one man or by one class of men. And his law cannot exist without the sanction and support of a preponderating force, it must finally place this force in the hands of those who legislate. This inevitable phenomenon, combined with the fatal tendency which we have said exists in the heart of man, explains the almost universal perversion of law. It is easy to conceive that, instead of being a check upon injustice, it becomes its most invincible instrument. It's easy to conceive that, according to the power of the legislator, it destroys for its own profit, and in different degrees, amongst the rest of the community, personal independence by slavery, liberty by oppression, and property by plunder. It is in the nature of men to rise against the injustice of which they are victims. When, therefore, plunder is organized by law for the profit of those who perpetrate it, all the plundered classes tend, either by peaceful or revolutionary means, to enter in some way into the manufacturing of laws. These classes, according to the degree of enlightenment at which they have arrived, may propose to themselves two very different ends. When they thus attempt the attainment of their political rights, either they may wish to put an end to lawful plunder, or they may desire to take part in it. Woe to the nation where this latter thought prevails amongst the masses, at the moment when they in turn seize upon the legislative power. Up to that time, lawful plunder has been exercised by the few upon the many, as is the case in countries where the right of legislating is confined to a few hands. But now it has become universal, and the equilibrium is sought in universal plunder. The injustice which society contains, instead of being rooted out of it, is generalized. As soon as the injured classes have recovered their political rights, their first thought is not to abolish plunder. This would suppose them to possess enlightenment, which they cannot have, but to organize against the other classes, and to their own detriment, a system of reprisals, as if it was necessary before the reign of justice arrives that all should undergo a cruel retribution, some for the iniquity and some for their ignorance. Doesn't that sound a little bit like the current American political system, where a transfer of power simply moves the target from the backs of one group to another? One of the things that I noticed about the 2016 election, when it came to Republicans, one of the things that they liked about Trump, and this is telling of about Trump, but it's even more telling about the Republicans that vehemently supported him. One of the things that I heard, and this is strictly anecdotal, but one of the things that I heard the most was that what they liked about him was that he hurt the feelings of liberals. After 8 years of Obama, because he was mean. I didn't hear a lot of people talking about his great economic policies. I heard the old throwaway line of, well, he's a businessman, so he can run the economy like a businessman would. Never mind that when the government runs the economy, that's called socialism. But they were enjoying that the liberals, the left, the Democrats were going to suffer for what they did over the past 8 years. And when Obama came to office, it was the right, the Republicans, that were going to suffer. And it was going to be payback to the political enemies of the Bush years. History doesn't always repeat itself, but it often rhymes. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Biptunia, music for the drive to Alpha Centauri. Biptunia's influences are Gary Numan, Brian Eno, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, Robert Fripp, Blondie, Kraftwerk, and Dead Kennedys. Biptunia styles are trip-hop, rock, pop, glam, industrial, ambient, jazz, and space. Plus, it's got cats and is covered by the BIPCOT NoGov license. You can download Biptunia's music free. Go to biptunia.com. That's B-I-P-T-U-N-I-A. Bravo, India, Papa, Tango, Uniform, November, India, Alpha. Biptunia.com.
Go to the website, getcell411.com. It is a free download. Use this to maintain contact with your friends, family, and neighbors. You are your own first line of defense. You are your own first responder. This will help you to set up a network to where you can communicate with your friends, family members, and neighbors, and not rely upon the government to try to help you out. Back to Bastiat. It would be impossible, therefore, to introduce into society a greater change and a greater evil than this, the conversion of the law into an instrument of plunder. What would be the consequences of such a perversion? It would require volumes to describe them all. We must content ourselves with pointing out the most striking. In the first place, it would efface from everybody's conscience the distinction between justice and injustice. No society can exist unless the laws are respected to a certain degree. But the safest way to make them respected is to make them respectable. The safest way to make the laws respected is to make them respectable. When law and morality are in contradiction, citizen finds himself in the cruel alternative of either losing his moral sense or of losing his respect for the law, a magnitude between which it would be difficult to choose. And I go back to Martin Luther King. One has a moral right to disobey unjust laws. I go back to Thomas Jefferson. If a law is unjust, a man is not only right to disobey it, he is obligated to do so. I don't consider this to be a difficult choice. I don't being able to put my self-respect on a much higher level than my respect for the declarations of politicians. Bastiat also wrote, "When plunder becomes a way of life, men create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it." And when people shout out, "It's the law," as a response in their support, in their chorus of obedience, they are justifying it. They're glorifying it. They're glorifying the violations of life, liberty, and property rather than the protection of life, liberty, and property.